Hi, everybody. Today's Wednesday, June 18th, 2025. Our friends Ray McGowan and John Helmer are back with us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dima.
Let me start with the latest comment on the part of Donald Trump about the conflict between Israel and Iran. Here is what he said.
There you are moving closer, you believe the U.S. is moving closer to striking Iranian nuclear facilities. Where's your mindset on that?
I can't say that, right? Well, you don't seriously think I'm going to answer that question. Will you strike the Iranian nuclear component? And what time exactly, sir? Sir, would you strike it? Would you please inform us so we can be there and watch? I mean, you don't know that I'm going to even do it. You don't know. I may do it. I may not do it. I mean, nobody knows what I'm going to do. I can tell you this, that Iran's got a lot of trouble and they want to negotiate. And I said, why didn't you negotiate with me before all this death and destruction? Why didn't you negotiate? I said to the people, why didn't you negotiate with me 2 weeks ago? You could have done fine. You would have had a country. It's very sad to watch this. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It's so, you know, everyone thought it was going to be the reverse. I didn't think so. And I was telling them, you got to do something. You got to negotiate. And at the end, last minute, they said, no, we're not going to do that. And they got hit. Remember 60 days? And then came the 60. 61 is going to become a very famous number. That was one hell of a hit, that first hit. That was one hell of a hit. Not sustainable, to be honest. That's where it ended. It ended on the first night. Yes.
Is it too late, though? Do you think it's too late to now?
Really? Nothing's too late. The only thing too late is Powell. Powell's too late. Too late, Powell.
John, go ahead. Your take on what he said.
Well, he gets some of the phrases correct. The fact is that it's too late in many respects for Donald Trump. He's impatient, he's pathologically violent, and if he doesn't strike, he will demonstrate that the United States, as well as Israel, have lost escalation dominance, escalation control. And the fact is, and it's a fact that I'm not in a position to confirm, that Iran has not lost its air defenses. They're being held in reserve. They're being held in reserve in such a way that the advisors to President Trump are advising him that they're being held in reserve, that there's a serious risk of the kind of air attack that's being prepared. US tankers, F-35s, F-15s, You can all read the way these are being redeployed from the United States across Europe down to the Middle East. The first thing is that unless the United States demonstrates escalation control here and dominance, Trump isn't a paper tiger. He's reduced to a level he can't bear. And that would encourage even more violence, but even more loss. Second, on the Iranian side, there's only one way to understand what they're doing, notwithstanding all the confusion. And all Americans know it. It's called rope-a-dope. Rope-a-dope, the tactic of one of the greatest of all Americans, Muhammad Ali, used to fight by having his body against the ropes, allowing the elasticity of the ropes to allow him to withstand massive amounts of punching by his enemy until his enemy got tired. When his enemy got tired, watch what Muhammad Ali does. It's a beautiful, brilliant display of counterviolence. And he simply tears the adversary apart, having opened up the vulnerability of exhaustion. Now, exhaustion is what Israel faces if it can't continue to supply its anti-aircraft defenses with new missiles, and it can't refuel its missile offenses, and it can't get close enough to the Russian air defense system, the S-400s and others in Iran, if it can't get close enough and it runs out of supply and it's desperate for U.S. intervention, both to resupply Israel and to take on the burden of escalation and attack. If the U.S. doesn't, if Iran absorb the punishment for another 7 to 10, 14 days, the rope-a-dope will reverse.
Ray, go ahead.
I'd start out by saying, you know, Trump is completely unpredictable. We've been saying that for many, many years. Happens to be true. So all we can say really is our best guess from our own experience as to what's going to happen now. So please put what my remarks in the sphere of speculation. I think it's pretty clear that Netanyahu did not tell Trump, at least did not give him chapter and verse as to what the Israelis were going to do before they did it. Now, how do you explain Trump's reaction, the elation, saying, beautiful, excellent, those Israelis, that's terrific. Because on Thursday night, he was told, hey, Mr. President, we've neutered the air defense systems in Iran. We have total dominance over the airspace. Look what we're doing. The Israelis have pretty much won this thing, okay? That he was told by very inept military advisors, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who really hasn't been all that good. So what did he do? That's why he reacted. Oh, yeah, I knew all about it, right? I knew all about it. Well, you know, what was he going to say when people asked him, did you know about this beforehand? Well, it appeared to Trump that the Israelis have pretty much won. So he's not going to say, beat the hell out of me. Maybe you never told me nothing. No, he's going to say, oh, yeah, you told me. Yeah, I knew all about it. I know everything. Talk about phantasmagoria. I know everything. Okay, now he's got his ambassador in Israel telling him that it's God's will, that Trump just listen and then do what the God who is the real estate broker with respect to the West Bank and the other occupied territory, just listen to what that particular God tells him. Okay, let me get back to the reality here. If it's true that Trump didn't know, then he's just been going with the flow, okay? It wasn't too long before he said, no, I didn't know anything about it. And then, you know, he goes to Canada. What amazing spectacle in Canada. He reams out his G7 or the G6s, absent. The G7 has Trump in it, okay? He reams out the G6 and saying, look, you guys are crazy. You never should have let Russia, expelled Russia from the G8. Who were you thinking back in 2014? You know, you should let them back in, for God's sake. If you didn't expel them, there would be no war in Iran, in Ukraine. And, and I can guarantee that. He threw the whole thing into disarray. And then he said, and the Chinese too, you let the Chinese in. Think about it. This, oh, by the way, I don't have time to stay for dessert. I'm going home to reign over my National Security Council. Well, the next day, the National Security Council convenes, and the word is America is going to join in the fray, right? That's that evening, okay? So what happens? Well, in my view, this is speculative, but the Russians weighed in with Trump and said, look, you've been deceived. We know that you've been mousetrapped by Netanyahu again. You better not do this. It's not a good idea, okay? And so there's the first bump in the night that doesn't happen, okay? Trump does not authorize the U.S. to get involved with Israel against Iran militarily in an offensive way for the nuns. Who knows? Okay. Now, that's big. So that bump in the night didn't happen. What's the other bump in the night that didn't happen? If memory serves, Khamenei, the supreme leader, said about this time yesterday, watch what's going to happen today. The biggest thing in the whole world is going to happen today. Watch out. Okay. Didn't happen. There was a bump in the night. Didn't happen. Why? Now, Khamenei is not going to say those things without being able to follow through. Something happened to prevent him from doing this major thing that will be historical. I forget his exact words, but it's pretty rare for him to say these things. It didn't happen. So what happened? Well, other people's saner voices entered the fray. I would bet that Witkoff or maybe Trump himself got in touch with Iranians and said, we don't know what you have in mind, but if it has to do, okay, look, we're not going to join the fray here, at least not now. So please, no bumps in the night. In other words, I see that some, I would say rational people have taken over. I'm just saying the events have evolved. So when Trump says, as he just did, this is not sustainable, I think he's thinking about the Israelis. And indeed, he got that right, as John said. It's not sustainable over more than a week, in my view, okay? Right. They're going to run out of things, and the U.S. doesn't even have those things in production, much less on the shelf, right? So I'm just saying that today, last thing, Ryabkov, the deputy foreign minister, who is pretty much Lavrov's next in power, he said at this St. Petersburg meeting, he said, look, the U.S. really should think twice about getting involved militarily. It's not a good idea. You hear that, U.S.? That's not a good idea at all, okay? So I see signs that that Trump is realizing that the people he should listen to are maybe the Russians and maybe the Chinese. And the last thing, Trump has said, the Russians have offered to mediate. I asked them if they could help. I asked them 3 weeks ago if they could help. Yeah, they're going to help now. And so, and I have nothing against the Russians mediating. That's big. So I'm, again, the glass half full person on this. I see things that that indicate to me that, that Trump may even be a little pissed, a little bit ticked off at the notion that although he bragged that he knew everything, he didn't, and he again, once, as we all warned, let himself be mousetrapped by the likes of Netanyahu.
John, have you watched the video that Donald Trump said he doesn't care about what Tulsi Gabbard said, and he has his own mindset? Yes, go ahead, and your take on that.
Well, it's quite interesting because the question, this is often not quoted, but the question put to him by the reporter was explicitly mentioned Tulsi Gabbard at her nomination hearing in March. And the reporter said correctly that she said then that the Iranians didn't have and weren't planning to have a nuclear weapon, a topic that Ray and colleagues, you and I, have discussed before. So we don't have to discuss whether that's true or false. We know what the intelligence community position was. Now, what Trump could have said was, a lot's changed since March, because that's what he was asked, but he didn't. What Trump did was attack her, his chief intelligence advisor. He could have said, a lot has changed since March. Have a look at the UN report. Have a look at the IAEA report. Have a look at this. Have a look at that. A lot has changed. He could have said it, and that would have let his intelligence chief off the hook, and it would have let him off the hook and preserved the cover story, the nuclear weapon cover story, to effect regime change and break Iran into several pieces. That's the real thing. But when confronted with a simple question, he attacked his own intelligence advisor. I don't care what she says. Now, at that point, he shows he can't bear the woman, the person, the advisor, the person he appointed to summarize, brief him, blah, blah, blah. Now, that insult, that disregard for the intelligence community, for the for his own appointment, should result in Tulsi Gabbard resigning. Both Ray and I have put out tweets in the last 24 hours, and we agree on that. No person can retain their honor, which means I will defend my right to express my opinion as best I can. And if the person who appoints me has such disrespect, I resign. She doesn't have to find any other reason, not the movement of aircraft, US Air Force aircraft against her recommendation. That's a policy disagreement. No. What has happened to Ms. Gabbard is so insulting to her office, her person, and her role. She must resign. In another country, ministers resign for less. But that's a demonstration she no longer has the trust or confidence of the head of state. She should resign, even if it'll cost her money. If she doesn't, she's disgraced herself. She wants to keep the money. She wants to keep the prestige. She wants to prove that she's a lapdog of that man. Now, I don't know what sort of a career you can have as an ex-intelligence chief working for Trump hotels, casinos, and golf courses, but to dishonor herself by staying on makes her unemployed in the world where people retain brains and honor.
Yeah, that world is dwindling, isn't it, John?
Yes.
I mean, there's a dearth of honor.
It's very small.
There's not much of it in Washington. Now, yes, I think she should resign. There's an almost as good argument saying, look, she's the last white hope, so to speak. She's the only one with any brains, for God's sake. We need her where she is, for God's sake. Maybe she'll succeed the next time. Okay, so I'm not advocating that, but that is a tenable argument. Now, just so the audience knows, once again, the intelligence community since 2007 has ruled that Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon. That has stopped working on a nuclear weapon in 2003 and has not resumed work on it. And it said that initially in 2007 with high confidence, unanimous 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. To their credit, each one of these estimates yearly since then has reiterated that position. As recently as 3 months ago, Tulsi Gabbard herself testified to that under oath. Okay. Now, the previous CIA director, a fellow named William Burns, who distinguished himself by telling a whole bunch of lies about Putin already losing in Ukraine 2 years ago. I guess when he was going out of office, he felt, well, maybe I should tell the truth on this really important issue so that the world can be spared from nuclear war. And he said, yes, reiterated, Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon. And we have such a capability to detect if it started working on a nuclear weapon that we would detect it very quickly. Okay. Whoa. So that's on the record. I just mentioned that because people need to remember that. Now, what Tulsi Gabbard did was reiterate all that. And what Donald Trump said is, forget about it. I don't give a rat's patootie what you or the intelligence community have said since 2007. I go with my other advisors, my neocons, who say, no, I think the Iranians are very close to it, okay? What does that do to the intelligence community? It gets rid of the last vestige of the old discipline under which I worked, where you tell the truth, right? The last vestige of standing up to power and not catering to the prevailing views. I have been astounded how my former colleagues working on Iran have done this every year. And so what Trump is saying is, look, I don't give a damn about what you say. I'm going to go ahead and do something. What is he going to do? Well, I don't know if he's going to do it, because I think the Russians and the Chinese have said, you do this, you're in trouble deep that you never even imagined. Besides, Israel cannot sustain this kind of thing. What's the other thing I want to mention here? Oh, yeah. Tulsi Gabbard is a sitting duck. I mean, Tulsi Gabbard said that James Comey should be in jail. Who is James Comey? He was the author, together with the CIA head John Brennan, of the spurious Russiagate. They have the goods on these people. Now, do these people say, oh, I hope I don't go to jail? No. They go after people who take on the deep state. And I notice that Tulsi Gabbard's spokesperson at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence has said, look, don't be deceived by the old playbook of the, quote, deep state, end quote. Whoa. So there's a battle royale going on in Washington. And as I say, the theory that she should quit as a matter of honor, well, I subscribe to that. I mean, honor is important. But there's so damn little of it left in Washington, I can equally see where she should hang around and pretend, as she did yesterday, my God, she said, we're on the same page. Trump and I are on the same. Come on, Tulsi, you're not on the same page. That's why I think she should resign. She should resign and say, look, this is my page. It's been the intelligence community's page since 2007. I resign, and I want you Americans to know, Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon. If they did start work, we would know very quickly, according to the former chief of the CIA. So what I'm saying here is that there are lots of extracurricular or extraneous reasons for the deep state to go after Tulsi Gabbard. And I'm sure that there were people telling Trump, look, don't pay any attention to her. Look what she's trying to do. Look what she's trying to do. Don't pay any attention. So Trump being mercurial, Trump being not so bright really about these things, and his being unpredictable. God knows what he's going to do. But I think the Russians and the Chinese have weighed in now. I think that actually the Iranians have sort of said, well, okay, let's see how this plays out. Let's not do our big explosion in the middle of the night. Let's see. Maybe the Israelis will finally realize that we have the upper hand here. We can sustain this thing far longer than this little country of Israel.
I don't agree with Ray on a couple of points here. The first place, the nuclear bomb issue is as much a smokescreen now for an attack on Iran, regime change, and the partition of Iran. That's the real strategic plan. And the nuclear weapons issues, a smokescreen, as weapons of mass destruction were the smokescreen that Colin Powell dishonored himself by lying at the beginning of the US attack on Saddam Hussein. An attack which ultimately succeeded, as we know. Now, the issue underneath the nuclear weapon issue is one on which Ms. Gabbard has not said she disagrees at all with Trump. And Trump isn't being mercurial about the empire. It's make the empire great again. The empire, not simply make America great again, it's mega. Make the empire great again. And I'm glad to hear that Colonel Wilkerson, who was the aide to Colin Powell when he was lying his head off at the outset of the attempt to change the regime in Iraq, is now using the term the empire, and correctly. The empire, in this case, is what Trump is trying to expand. He doesn't express it very well, but he expresses its meaning. And Gabbard doesn't disagree with the expansion of the empire. And that's what this is about. Ultimately, regime change in Iran means the partition of Iran, not taking account of all the ethnic diversity, the language differences, the history, and so forth, of Persia. And I tried to say the other day, show what the map would look like if partition into Kurds, Arabs, Baluchis, Azeris, what would that do to mini Persia? Okay, that's the real empire plan. And it's the last of the, let's call them, independent Middle Eastern bastions to fall to the empire after the partition of Syria, okay, and the destruction of Lebanon. But Lebanon doesn't count the way partition of Syria does. In that respect, I don't see the politics of Washington, Gabbard versus Trump, Trump versus various other advisors, General Kane and what have you. This is small beer compared to the big drive. And that drive doesn't depend on the personality of Netanyahu. Israel has always been part of the big empire. That's the reason Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union supported the creation of the State of Israel, in the belief that the Israeli state would be independent of the British Empire and the US Empire. When Stalin realized, when the Soviet leadership realized, Israel was a puppet state of the empire and would grow with the empire to threaten Russia, Stalin acted differently. The Soviet policy acted differently. Right now, so there's a problem that on the Russian side, as on the Chinese side, as on the North Korean side, the allies of Iran, of how you fight the empire. But one of the watchwords, one of the standard requirements of fighting the empire is you do it slowly, you do it patiently, you do it carefully, and you do it secretly. And you do it with deception that works. So in that respect, Trump isn't mercurial and unpredictable. He's the perfect enemy. He's so pathologically violent, impatient, incapable of waiting and deliberating or seeing a deception that plays to his advantage. He's all incapable of all of those things. So as the empire moves against Iran to knock out the last Middle Eastern fortress, China, which has its own war coming, and Russia, which is fighting its war now, but knows there'll be a future war on its northern front, its Arctic front, its eastern front. Russia knows this is coming. Therefore, Russia's position is against the empire, but not saying so, and not exposing itself to another round of US-led, British conceived Ukrainian attacks on Russia's strategic security. So I see the Washington politics here as minor compared to the central consensus which Trump is putting at risk.
Go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, a word about empire. Empire requires an emperor, and this emperor has no clothes on. The power has shifted in this world of ours. It's most basically two against one, Russia and China against the dwindling, diminishing empire. I think that's really the reality that forms that backdrop of all this stuff. The other thing I'd say, John, I don't disagree with what you said initially here. This is, of course, about regime change. It's not about nuclear weapons. I've already said they're not building a nuclear weapon. So it's got to be about regime change. But that day has passed, okay? They can no longer do regime change. Now, you mentioned Secretary Powell, Secretary of State, former General Colin Powell. His speech on 5 February 2003 was a disaster, okay? That's why they got rid of him. I mean, he was so bad that they didn't want him to do that. I mean, he did exactly what Bush and Cheney wanted him to do, but as soon as the first term was over, they appointed a real puppet called Condoleezza Rice to be the Secretary of State. And then what did they want to do? Well, they did such a good job on Iraq. I'm facetious here, such a good job. That somebody said, oh my God, now they're gonna do Iran. And there was nothing anybody could say. And say, look, Iran is not Iraq. I mean, Iran has 90 million people, for God's sake. They've got a nation nuclear capability. Please. And that's when this estimate came out. Now, what were the differences? Well, the differences were that Congress was not 99% in the pocket of the Israel lobby. It was only about 49%, okay? And the estimate was enough to prevent Bush from carrying out a war against Iran on his last year in office. Cheney wanted, of course, 2008. That estimate, November 2007, prevented that, okay? This time it's different. The estimate is the same. You know, the estimate is the same as has been the case since 2007. It's an honest estimate, unlike the one in 2002, 2003. It says Iran doesn't have any nuclear weapons and they're not working on them, okay? But the effect is different because you have Trump now, very mercurial, very unpredictable, and a Congress and all his, a lot of advisors that are worse than the ones that Bush and Cheney had. Can you believe it? So my bottom line is the differences speak for themselves. When you have a semi-sane voice like Tulsi Gabbard, and she continues to say very idiosyncratically, very uniquely, what the U.S. intelligence community feels about Iran nuclear, and when she's cashiered, well, that means that Trump doesn't feel bound by reality. He doesn't say what Bush said, oh, they've taken away the nuclear option from me. No, he's all back and forth, and bottom line for me, once again, is that it's very different this time because the intelligence community has been dissed, but at the same time, people know, and that what's going to happen here depends on how strong the Russians sotto voce tell Trump, look, man, you know, you've been had here. You've been had first and foremost by your advisors and then by Netanyahu. You're going to let him trap yourself into a war that we will have to come into one way or another to defend our interests and Chinese interests in the Persian Gulf.
John, one of these people that was captured by Iran intelligence, they were preparing these drones, producing these drones inside Iran. He said that they were preparing for this for almost 10 years.
Yes.
And look, considering that and considering what has happened to Russia and the similarity between the two attacks, the yes. way they started it, what comes to your mind? What are the outcomes? What can we get from that?
That's a very big question because Russian thinking about this, the Iran war and the Ukraine war, are far from settled. I don't agree with Ray. The Russian side is not telling Trump anything at all. Anything at all. They don't need to. they don't want to.
Yeah.
Well, Ryabkov can open his mouth as much as he likes, and so can the foreign minister, and so can the foreign ministry spokesman. And what they've been saying is evasive of the central points here. The fundamental, from a Russian point of view, is first, the United States called off the simplest, easiest format for having talks on modifying and reducing the so-called irritants between the two ministries. If Ryabkov has acknowledged that, and when that's off the table, Russia's focus is then what's on the table now that we've presented 33 points to the US side to agree or not agree. There's no confidence now that Trump and his people will agree on any term for the Ukrainian-Russian negotiations to come. First. Second, there is a profound problem inside the Russian policymaking establishment towards Israel. I've mentioned it before. We all know Russia doesn't discuss it, and it can't be discussed. President Putin has a particular fondness for the Israelis that is contrary to Russia's strategic interest, its military operational interest. It has resulted in the deaths of Russian servicemen in Syria and elsewhere. This is understood and not discussed. Third, the problem of Russian policymaking is at least clearer than the Chinese one. The Chinese have said almost nothing worth listening to, calling for negotiations, calling for the reduction of tensions. The issue here is very clear, as we've just said it to the Chinese, to the North Koreans, to the Russians. This is regime change. Those are the fundamental strategic existential threats that China faces from the United States and the empire, that China faces from the United States and the empire, that North Korea faces from the empire as well. They all understand this, and yet I hold up in my hand foreign ministry statements, including Ms. Zakharova's today, focusing on the IAEA. IAEA has been known as the Argentinian leader of that organization, Mr. Grossi, has demonstrated for years to be entirely politicized on the empire side. It's worthless. Why mention the IAEA and focus on the nuclear issue instead of the regime changing issue? Why is the foreign ministry saying that? Why did Mr. Vershinin say a few days ago that he was looking forward to the opening of airline connections that take Russians to go and have their holidays in Eilat? What should they do, Russians? Warm themselves by the heat of the genocide, watch the Houthi missiles going over Eilat? Vershinin, in fact, said that. So what does that mean? It means you don't take what foreign ministry officials say in Moscow as the full value of what Russia is having to decide now. The general staff, intelligence agencies, the president, and the forming of a consensus policy on how to respond to another empire war. First, don't act quickly. Second, don't allow the world to see that you might be betraying Iran as you have been perceived to have betrayed the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria. It's a crucial issue for Russia to establish and defend its credibility. Therefore, Sergei Shoigu was sent to Pyongyang, to North Korea, to reassure the North Koreans and to plan not only that North Koreans should help work in Kursk region to repair the damage and demine the territory, not only that, that's the announcement. The issue is reassurance that Russia stands by its commitments. to its treaty allies. Now, there's a problem that the foreign ministry, in its focus on IAEA, has avoided. The problem is this, and we said it last week, Russia has a treaty obligation to Iran. It has a treaty obligation to its strategic partner. It's less obliged when Iran is under attack than the Russian side would be if North Korea was under attack. We've explained that before. There's a difference between the treaties, but there's a word in the treaty that Mr. Pezeshkian President Putin signed on January. The word's cooperation. Now, what's the sign of it in anything? Ryabkov, Lavrov, Zakharova, or any Russian foreign ministry spokesman has said, not one of them has referred to that treaty. Not one of them has said, we are cooperating with Iran to the extent of our commitments under the treaty of January 2025, in accordance with the United Nations laws and codes and conventions and what have you. That would have put the language within that treaty, but they haven't said a word about the treaty. Why? Why? For several reasons which are unmentionable in Russian public discourse at the moment. One popped out with a colleague named Yevgeny Krutikov, a former GRU officer who writes very intelligently in Sklyad, which is a partially Kremlin-supported security publication in Moscow, Krutikov exposed the degree of internal dissension within Iran. He was reflecting thereby the Russian concern that Iran is internally divided, the regime is weak, that the regime has a problem, the IRGC has a problem, etc., etc. We don't need to go into that. I'm simply making the point that the Russian foreign ministry line here has been evasive and silent on key strategic issues and focused instead on the nuclear issue, which we've all agreed is a smokescreen. Second, the Russian priority is, will Trump push Zelensky into agreeing to any of the 33 terms tabled in Istanbul? That's crucial. And the weaker Trump appears to be in the Middle East, there's a Russian division of opinion, as there must be. Will Trump be more likely to agree to Russian terms for ending the war in the Ukraine? Then there's the issue of whether the war in the Middle East will divert arms and American attention away from the Ukraine, which gives Russia, in the middle of its spring-summer offensive, further opportunity to press forward westward, as we've talked about before, and try to begin to roll up more and more Ukrainian forces and endanger the entire regime in Kiev. That's got to be a Russian priority, fighting and winning that war. And President Putin, the foreign ministry, the general staff, and the intelligence service are all agreed that Trump must be given every opportunity to demonstrate the readiness of the United States to agree to end on Russian terms. And that's a priority. Keep him focused on Russian terms. Well, as Ray says, the man's unpredictable. If on the one hand he said one day we'll accept a level of low in nuclear enrichment in Iran, and then the next day no enrichment, zero enrichment, no weapon, blah, blah, blah. If he says one thing one day and another thing another day, what's he going to say next towards Russia and the Ukraine? Well, the Russians understand that's not exactly unpredictability. It's the predictable advance of the empire, which Russia must face, and not only in the Ukraine, but as I've said before, the Northern Front, the Arctic Front, the Far Eastern Front, and the Southern Front. Now, the Southern Front, from a Russian point of view, has always been dangerous. It was in World War II, it was in World War One, and Stalin's position was the only way to secure the southern front, meaning Iran, was to occupy northern Iran, build an Azeri mini republic, or make a deal with the regime in Tehran, the father Shah, the younger Shah, or the Republican Parliament. When Stalin could fail to reach deals, he pulled the troops out and reached a sort of accommodation, both with the Iranian regime at the time and the US at the time. This is very complicated, but it's war with the empire on the southern front. And that's not something Mr. Ryabkov, not something Mr. Lavrov is going to be able to communicate to the likes of Trump or his advisors. Instead, they will feed in public what they think he wants to hear. And worse, you have at the moment the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, in which is being displayed the president's advisor, Kirill Dmitriev, for international economic relations and, let's say, buying the appeal of the Trump family and the Lapnik family and the Vitkov family and all the other oligarchs who run the United States at the moment, and give them enough financial incentive to find peace with Russia. It's highly odd, as if Dmitriev doesn't pay attention to what's happening in the rest of the world. He thereby shows in his statements that he gave in the last 24 hours in St. Petersburg that Russia wants to see U.S. business in the United back into Russia. And he's saying that at the same time that Russia has a commitment to cooperate with Iran, which is under attack. That's the way it is. And when that is said, it's understood to reflect, I'm not expressing a difference of opinion with Mr. Dmitriev. I'm simply saying to you, you watch what they're doing, and it's a multiplicity of voices reflecting a multiplicity of priorities. And in a war, in several wars, in a sequence of wars, in which Russia cannot afford to fight all of them at the same time.
Yeah, let me just say, John, I don't think you really believe that under that cooperation treaty that Russia has an obligation to support Iran militarily. It's very different. That's why it took 2+ years to negotiate this treaty. The Russians didn't want to be put in the position that if what happened last week, namely Israel attacked Iran, that Russia would be obligated to give anything more than cooperation, not military support. You draw a distinction between that and the treaty with North Korea, which does obligate each side to come to the aid of the other if they're attacked. So when Russia was attacked in Kursk, the treaty was invoked. The North Koreans sent troops there. Now they're sending more because Lavrov asked them to. Besides that, American intelligence knows, but nobody else knows, that the Russians gave the North Koreans the next most sophisticated ICBMs 3 years ago, and we detected it, but Jake Sullivan decided, oh, we're not going to make an issue out of that. We're not going to advertise that North Korea has the capability to hit every part of the United States, including Mar-a-Lago, okay? So that's a real treaty. The one with Iran was deliberately negotiated to prevent either side to having come to the aid of the other in case of an attack, which just happened. Now, Ryabkov, he just said that a couple hours ago. Perhaps you didn't read it or hear of it, but this is at the state. You did read it. Okay. Now, I understood you to say that doesn't matter. Well, he is Lavrov. When Lavrov is not speaking, he's the foreign minister, And what is he saying is a really good idea, you Trump, not to engage militarily in Iran. That is significant. Now, why did he mention the IAEA? And by the way, Grassi is from Spain. He's not
Argentina. He's from Argentina.
Okay, well, we'll look at that. We'll look that up. But I was told he's from Spain. In any case, that has been a charade. The IAEA has been under the U.S. thumb for, let's see, since 2003, for over 25 years. It used to have this fellow named El Baradei, an Egyptian who took his job seriously. And when yellow cake uranium was raised by Dick Cheney, he put his people to work, and it took them a whole day to Google the answer and to say that El Baradei said before the UN Security Council, I'll never forget it, Baradei said that these reports about Iraq getting yellow cake uranium from deepest, darkest Africa in the Shia are not authentic. They were forgeries. We know that now. Now, that's the way it was then. Now we have this guy. Oh, there's this picture, Grassi. Well, what does it say?
I can't read the small print.
It does say. It does say Argentine diplomat. My God, I guess you're right.
Argentine diplomat's a qualification to be a stooge. We both agree to that. And Russia's made it very clear. Grassi has never been anything but a stooge and has allowed the Ukrainians and the United States and the British to attack Zaporozhye. He's a stooge.
Right.
Why now, say it again?
Two days before the Israeli attack, the Board of Governors of the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, decades old, okay? As I say, it's a UN body, but now it's completely a US body. The Board of Governors, who are completely biased toward the West, decided that, Iran has been violating their various agreements about nuclear undertakings. And what did that mean? Well, that meant that this group is just completely under the U.S. thumb. Even in Zaporozhye, as you rightly point out, they're unwilling to say, well, those missiles came from the West, so they might be Ukrainian missiles. It's crazy, okay? So all I'm saying is that when Ryabkov, as he did, cites the IAEA, he said, look, guys, you all know what this is about. And not coincidentally, Israel was given the kind of the green light by the IAEA, whose own inspectors may have been killed in Iran, to go ahead and do what they did a week ago. So that's that. Now, let me just finish here. Yeah, Shoigu. So he goes to North Korea and does those things. Now, the other thing I want to say is that when you note that that Mr. Putin has been pretty partial to Israel, that has to do with a lot of things. That has to do partly with 1 million Russians with Russian passports now living in Israel. He's got to be careful about that. Would he be loath to welcome them back, even though they're pretty old, they're pretty adept, and they can help the Russian economy, which is short of manpower? Anyhow, the fact that he's been seen as partial to Israel, or at least impartial, well, that puts him in the perfect spot to be able to say, well, I can mediate this thing, okay? The Israelis, I like the Israelis. The Iranians, I like the Iranians. And the wonder is that Trump, 3 weeks ago, asked Putin to see if he could help out with Iran. And now he says again, the Iranians are, the Russians are still willing to do that. So that means that when the Russians say, look, that offer is still on the table, we can mediate. And Trump says, I've got nothing against that. Well, that means that the Americans and the Russians are actually collaborating here. And just to make sure that the Americans know where Russia stands, Ryabkov gets up and says, hey, you better not even think about joining in the Israeli offensive attack against Iran.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I think we could move on a couple of steps. Yes, there's a profound difference between the Korean and the Iranian treaty. Second, the level of cooperation between Russia and Iran is secret, and it says so in the treaty. There are separate terms of agreement for Russia to maintain the aircraft it has supplied to Iran, the air defenses and other weaponry it has supplied to Iran, the intelligence sharing that enables Iran to anticipate seeing over the horizon the enemies are coming. These are all things which are kept secret, and I'm not going to be disclosing them if I knew them. However, they are real. And that level of cooperation with Iran is tempered by 200 years of history in which, and we've talked about this, you and I, Nima, in the past, in other programs, 200 years of history of the Persians and the Russians fighting each other. And the Russian side has to remember that it was called the Lesser Satan by Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979. And Khomeini rejected a lot of attempts that the Soviet Union made at that time to have a better relationship with Iran than had been possible under the US-dominated Shah. The terms for Russia to have a good relationship with Iran and the Arabs and Israel are spelled out in the foreign ministry's paper on mutual security in the Persian Gulf, and that's the paper that gives Mr. Ryabkov his marching orders. And that paper clearly rules out the U.S. empire in the Middle East. It rules out an expansion of Israel in the Middle East. It rules out the kind of destruction of the Arab regimes that has occurred between the United States and Israel throughout the Middle East, North Africa, and so on. So it's very clear what Russian strategy is. It's also clear that there have been a number of serious problems, not only for 200 years, but certainly since the Islamic regime came to power. Now, without getting too sensitive about this, there's a problem that Iran side has to convince the Russian side. It's in control of itself. The murder of President Raisi and Foreign Minister Amir Abdollahian is only 1 year ago. Therefore, I say murder. I tried to do the best I can to assemble the evidence that was not a helicopter accident, and it was not an Israeli operation. It was not an American operation, and it was not a Russian one. In the circumstances of that, over the past year, the terms of cooperation between Russia and Iran have had to be negotiated with successors like Mr. Pezeshkian. I don't pretend to understand the internal politics. Correct me, Nima. Fill us in from what you know. But there is a problem of Russian commitment to a side that seems divided against itself. Okay? Therefore, what is happening at the moment is a Russian line of being patient and counseling everybody not to go up the escalation ladder. At the same time, secretly, at the appropriate levels, Russia understands who the enemy is. And the general staff certainly does, and so do the intelligence services. At that level, it's understood that any gains by Israel and the United States against Iran will reflect themselves on the Ukrainian battlefield. Everybody in Russia knows that Israel backs the Ukraine in this war. Now, this counsels patience, silence, two things that are anathema to the President of the United States. So in the present situation, it's necessary for Russia to watch and wait. What's the best posture for watching and waiting? Well, let's see. Let's see if, and I've tried to do it, show a map. We'll do post this afterwards. See if Russia ships resupplies, fresh supplies to Iran across the Caspian Sea. For the moment, when I'm looking at the vessel movements across the Caspian Sea, there is no movement from Makhachkala, Olya, and Astrakhan, the Russian ports, to the Iranian ports. Then there'd be the route through Turkmenistan. If China and Russia were to help the Iranians secretly, that can come by railroad and by road through Turkmenistan into Iran, but it's secret. Now, the evidence, the logistic traces will be visible. They're not yet.
John, John, we know that Russian aircraft and Chinese aircraft on an expedited basis have already landed in Iran to give emergency resupply. So, you know, overland takes a long time, but Iran is under attack now. Transport aircraft carrying cargo for the war have already come from Russia and from China, and we can know that because we know about these planes. So, yeah, so I think China and Russia will play a terrific role here. China, I think, well, Iran's oil exports through the Gulf, I think about 40% of it, correct me if I'm wrong, but at last count, 40% of it goes to China and forms a good percentage of what China needs. Now, China is not going to, as we used to say, sit by idly here and watch the Gulf of Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz be closed. And neither is Russia. And neither, if they have any sense at all left, the Europeans, everybody realizes what will happen. So there's great incentive to tamp this thing down. And I think the Russians are really interested in doing that. They just have to make sure that Trump knows that, look, you thought the Israelis were winning. You said, oh, this is excellent. This is excellent. Oh, we dominate the airways. You may still say you dominate the airways, but you don't, Mr. Trump. Get real, and for God's sake, don't goad Netanyahu into thinking that you in the final analysis will come and bail him out, because that would mean real trouble, Mr. Trump. Do you understand? Real trouble.
Well, the thing I can add there is that it's not in the interest of Russia on one side or Iran in the middle or the United States on the other side to see a test of the S-400s against U.S. Air Force F-15s and F-35s. It's not an interest unless one side is absolutely certain they can win. Now, if the United States claims it's destroyed the Russian air defenses of Iran, and I believe that to be false, let's see what sort of test on the Iranian battlefield Russian equipment versus U.S. equipment will prove to be. On the Ukrainian battlefield, Russia is dominant. It has escalation dominance, it has air superiority, and it has destroyed the entire Patriot missile operation in the Ukraine. The Iranians have established that they have escalation dominance over the THAAD, over the Patriot, over the Iron Dome, and over the David Sling. Yes, those systems can intercept, but they can't intercept the hypersonic missiles that Iran is firing. And let's go back to the rope-a-dope. Let's go back to the arithmetic. Israel fires at least five missiles against one Iranian missile. And at this rate, over the next 10 days, as Ray was saying, or 2 weeks, Israel's going to run out, and Iran is nowhere near deploying all of its best stuff. So escalation dominance, escalation superiority wins wars. And Iran is holding more reserve and has got its arms around the clock. And the U.S. has to technically, strategically say, we don't want to lose this one. And it's therefore got to find a ceasefire arrangement. And as Ray said, President Putin's popped up and said, I volunteered to be the mediator. And that may in fact be the face-saving out for the United States, and Netanyahu will do basically what the United States wants. But as you've heard from President Trump, he's nowhere near agreeing to a ceasefire because he thinks he's winning. And if he's not, it's going to take 10 more days. That's when a Russian mediation might work. As for the Chinese, the Chinese have a very peculiar notion of thinking that money talks louder than force. They think they can buy their way strategically in the Middle East. They have been a dismal failure in every state I can think of. They succeed where there's no display and no test of force by using money. And they do that very effectively in Africa and other places. They show no, absolutely no Chinese capacity to defend or to deploy. They've had naval exercises with the Iranians and the Russians, yes. But their force commitment in the regions is puny and it's symbolic. Yes, they've got to defend Iran as an economic lifeline for them. Yes, they have to do that, but their force capability doesn't match the size of their economic interest. Now, what do countries do when they don't put up enough force to defend their economic interest? What they do is they retreat. And the evidence of Chinese statements, well-meaning, are true about mediation, don't escalate, blah, 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 that's retreat. The Chinese are running away because they haven't prepared sufficient force to defend their national interest.
Yeah, let me just interject very briefly that there are other ways the Chinese can shake the sword, so to speak. All they have to do is do some aggressive things in the South China Sea or the East China Sea or near the Philippines or near Taiwan. It's all the same game. Yeah, the Chinese are not going to send warships into the Persian Gulf, but they have lots of warships and they could send them elsewhere. Now, I don't think that's likely just now, but it's an option for the Chinese. As I say, Russia and China are joined at the hip now. It's two against one. India is interested in all this, and so is Pakistan. Last thing I'll say on that is Pakistan, as we all know, has nuclear weapons, and there were reports that in extremis, Pakistan would give those nuclear weapons to Iran. Well, I don't know if it's going to happen, but it's a possibility. So the thing is very, very volatile.
Pakistan has got a war in its hands with India. They've just had their nuclear warhead storages destroyed by the Indian side. Pakistan can't lend anything to anyone else. They're in a position where they're forced to a ceasefire. Now, I know lots of folks listening to us want to disagree with me on what happened between Pakistan and India, but let's just say they're at war and they're in ceasefire. What Pakistan is reported to be offering Iran is nonsense. They are in no position to do more than talk. Now, we've just seen, we haven't seen any readout yet, that President Trump hosted at lunch today in Washington the chief of the general staff, a field marshal of the Pakistan army. and Munir Shah, I think, is correct name. No readout, but it's very clear Pakistan is potentially to be brought toward the US from China. But right now, it's not right to say Pakistan's going to help Iran. The Muslim world, the Arab world can't and won't help Iran. They'll say the right things. But we're agreed it's Russia first because it must maintain the reputation of its arms. It must. Strategically, that's a Russian strategic objective, and it must make sure that the Southern Front doesn't become a platform, as Stalin was afraid it would become, for the penetration of Russia in the Caucasus and so on. This is a strategic must. China doesn't have that strategic necessity. Where China puts its force, where its money is just as you said, Ray, where its territorial interests are challenged in the South China Sea, in Taiwan, around the Philippines, around Japan. That's where China puts the right amount of force to defend the right amount of economic interest. But it's got nothing like that. The balance of power for China in the Persian Gulf, they've run a couple of well-armed destroyers up and down to show the flag. They take exercises, but they don't do anything serious. Serious means match your force to your interest, not the Chinese.
Let me just say that I know a little bit about Pakistan. They can walk and chew gum at the same time. But what I'm saying is, you know, there's a ceasefire now. If I'm Benjamin Netanyahu, I'm not going to say, oh, those Pakistanis, they have this, they seem to be more aggressive and more responsible and more reactive to the plight of Muslims than these clowns in Ankara or Beirut. My God, can I exclude that these reports might someday, like maybe next week, come true that one or two nuclear weapons are found in Iran and threatened to use against us? So what I'm saying is a matter of perception. I think you're right, John. The chances are that Pakistan will not do this, but whether Netanyahu can be sure of that, given the really strong rhetoric and the previous behavior of Pakistan as opposed to things like, Erdogan in Turkey. The other thing is that the Chinese are really in big on this, and they're together with the Russians. I was going to say one other thing here. The Chinese statements have been very, very strong. Yeah, they're not threatening, but they're not just issuing serious warnings that they did back in the day. So I'll leave it there, but we have a calculus here where Pakistan is not a thing that Netanyahu can simply prescind from and say, well, don't have to worry about them. They do have nukes, and they have had these reports that they might give the Iranians one or two of them.
Yeah. Thank you so much, John and Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nima.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Nima, and thank you, John.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.